John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And who wants to have some fun, creative fun?
What then? Who's next?
Pick me.
Yes, the little Sheila down the front. Mr. Waternoose, there's no time for
this. Come on, what are you waiting for? Roar!
But sir!
Roar!
Those unforgettable characters from Pixar feel like part of the family, you know? But how they came to be and how the company came to be an entertainment giant is not a technology story or the result of computers with fancy graphics. It's a story of mobilizing talent, leadership, and creativity. Could a Pixar-like transformation help your company, help our nation? The co-founder of Pixar, Ed Catmull, joins us later this hour to talk about how Monsters, Inc. is, in fact, Creativity, Inc. But we will begin this hour with a story of information and content that is less about adorable little monsters and fishies than huge multi-billion-dollar sharks, companies trying to get bigger, to own the pipeline, the internet, cable, telephone, every information, door, and window into your life. We're talking about the proposed merger of Time Warner and Comcast.
What will happen to the next Netflix that today is still just a dream in a garage? We want to make sure that the next new and competitive online service will be able to get their content to the merged company's growing consumer base. Technology and market innovation should result in Americans receiving better services and more value, not less service and less value.
That's Senator Amy Klobuchar from today's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, where number one Comcast has been defending its desire to purchase number two Time Warner Cable for $45 billion. Do the math. Largest cable company plus the second largest cable company equals another largest cable company, dwarfing everybody else. Which infuriates David Carr, media and culture columnist for our partner, The New York Times, who has been banging the drum about this proposed merger for quite a while. Welcome, David.
Hi, John.
So Comcast, Time Warner Cable, this is a business story. Why are you bothering with it?
Because it's very big business, and we're talking about something that is really deeply embedded in consumers' lives. It isn't really about cable. It's about the internet, and the internet is sort of like your water faucet or your electrical outlet. You expect to turn it on and have it work.
And this is a no place to hide kind of merger here, that once this takes place, wherever you live, how you get your internet, how you get your television, how you get your communications, your connection to the outside world is really going to be determined by a very few companies?
Well, I think that's sort of been the case already. The argument that consumer advocates are making is that it's going to further centralize what had been a limited array of choices in terms of where you get your internet from. Comcast would argue that, well, we got DirecTV, we got Dish, but they can't provide you a hardwired connection to the internet, which is what most American consumers and businesses care about.
And Time Warner can do that.
Time Warner, Comcast, by some measures, their wire will go by 70% of American homes. They will be providing 40% of the broadband in America and 30% of the cable.
And it simplifies everything. One person to call for all these services. It reduces the customer service waiting times if you got a problem.
I can hear Comcast and Time Warner Cable customers just laughing as you say that.
No, and I say that tongue in cheek, but that is their argument. Bringing them together just makes it more efficient.
I think Mr. Cohen would argue that a company like his needs scale to compete. They're in a very expensive business. They have stuff underground, overhead, and all that infrastructure takes a lot of money, and that this scale will give them the money they need to invest to compete with what they say is Apple, Amazon, Netflix, a whole new cohort of companies that are in their space providing video.
Aren't they onto something here in that Netflix competes very directly with the networks? Hulu competes with the networks? Amazon is gearing up to compete with the networks.
Yeah, they've got something to say about that. But in the instance of Comcast, you have somebody that controls both the pipes and to some degree what goes in them. Don't forget that they own NBC Universal. So they not only come to your house with the cable, but they're the ones that give you community for better or worse, the TV show or even a theme park. So they're everywhere. What people like Apple and Netflix would argue, and they would do it quietly because they're really afraid of angering Comcast, is that they're controlling the intersect with the consumer. They're the ones who are going to have the skin on your television that's going to decide whether you can watch Netflix in a reliable way, whether you can get Apple's devices authenticated on your television. They worry that they're going to have market power to kind of squeeze off and determine who can come across the bridge.
All right, so let's encapsulate a lot of what you've said in a quote that you wrote in the New York Times recently. This is in February. For consumers, cable is not just television anymore. You've said that. It's where the internet comes from. Should this deal go through, more people who want to cut the cable cord will still have to buy their broadband from a cable company where prices go only one way up. Well, David Cohen had this to say about your statement in February on C-SPAN last month.
A lot of respect for David Carr, but a lot of mistakes in that statement. So, first of all, in terms of buying broadband today, consumers are going to have the same choices after this transaction as they had before this transaction. The implication of that particular theory is that somehow this transaction is going to reduce choice for the purchase of broadband. That is just not true at all. Number two, according to the FCC, 93% of Americans have access to broadband, to wireline broadband today, and 97% of them have a choice of at least two broadband providers. So it's not a single choice market, again, as Mr. Carr represents.
David Cohen, Comcast Executive Vice President, on message there, talking about David Carr, our guest from the New York Times. You want to take any of that?
Well, I think his argument on pricing sort of goes over the windmill and through the clown's mouth to arrive at the same conclusion I did, which is prices are not going down. And Mr. Cohen has said that himself. If this deal is going to result in such savings and such economies of scale, how about showing the consumer a little sugar? How about we get to dip our beak in too?
All right, but there's also an argument here that maybe this goes back to the common carrier argument that, you know, the phone company dealt with. Maybe we want them to consolidate, become a big target, one company doing all of this, and then we'll put a fence around them, get the FCC, as David Cohen even alluded to there, get the FCC to regulate them, and then we'll have a secure access to the internet. That's where we should go, not stopping this merger.
Well, there are a lot of people that argue that the internet should come from one provider, that it should be treated like a public utility rather than a private good, and that maybe there is an argument for centralization, but it shouldn't be in the hands of a single company.
David Carr, media and culture columnist for our partner, our oft-times partner, The New York Times. David, thanks so much.
Pleasure to speak, John.
Later this hour, creativity and technology conspire to produce some of the most memorable movies in history. A look at Pixar's team approach to creativity with the company's co-founder. But it's a team approach of a very different kind that makes software vulnerable to hackers. A team of encryption experts from Finland has discovered a flaw in a communications program embedded in browsers and the networking software that controls how computers securely talk to each other without you having to input passwords every few nanoseconds. Creative teams of hackers looking for this kind of thing seem to have struck gold. The so-called Heartbleed bug in the OpenSSL program library opens a door into supposedly secure files and computers, allowing copying, stealing, and other tampering with data without leaving a trace. That's the key. Manoush Zamarodi is host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City. Welcome.
Hi, John. Good to see you.
So we know that some folks, some hackers, preceded the Finnish cryptographic experts in figuring this out.
Yes. Well, it sounds like this bug has been around for a while, nearly 2 years. And what makes it so serious is that it doesn't leave any trace. You have no idea what's been taken or even if anything has been taken. But the way it works, there was a lovely description this morning in The Verge, which is one of my favorite tech websites. And it described it like fishing. Literally, you take a big net and you haul it in, and sometimes you haul in nothing, but sometimes you could haul in millions of people's passwords or even the keys to the databases of these big companies like Yahoo, like Amazon.
And that's because OpenSSL is this cryptographic library. It basically is a set of tools that allow computers to speak to each other. And if you can take snapshots of what's going on in OpenSSL, you might have at any given time huge numbers of secure passwords and identity keys, exactly as you're talking about.
And that's why they're calling the bug Heartbleed, because they call those going back and forth between the computer's heartbeats, checking that the other one is there. Are you still there? Are you still open with my password in there? Yes, I am. We can still keep sending secure information. Oops, wait, somebody also is here, but we didn't know it.
All right, is this going to change the level of, I guess it's not transparency, it's just this happens behind the curtain. We don't have to bother with this because these OpenSSL software programs are around. Is this going to change that? Do we have to be more on top of things? Or is there a nice, simple upgrade fix
that
we can
nice?
Download?
Well, I think... Finally, this might be the moment where we start to take our passwords more seriously. There's someone online who is saying this is not, on a scale from 1 to 10, this is an 11 in terms of the emergency level. So for an example for me is I went onto one of these websites, and I can show you, where they're telling you what's happening to certain ones. I put in my bank, for example, and it got an F rating saying that it was exposed. You can see, though, that it seems to have put in the patch here, so it's getting back up to an A level. But until all
so it's not just so it's not just you have a patch.
No.
All the people that you deal with have to have the patch, or otherwise you're vulnerable.
Not only do they have to have the patch, they need to be researched. Certified. So what you should do is consider using a service like LastPass, which is a doubly, triply encrypted service that creates encoded passwords for all of your websites. If it sounds like a pain in the neck, it kind of is, but maybe this is the wake-up call we consumers need. Because I don't know about you, John, but I've been just sort of rolling the dice and hoping I wouldn't be the one who got hacked.
Her heart bleeds for all of us regarding the Heartbleed bug. Manush Zomorodi is host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
So this week we've been giving some of you the chance to get closure for any of those emotional loose ends left over from high school or even way back in grade school.
This is Marco from Oklahoma City. In second grade, I bullied a young girl. Her name was Bess. I don't even remember her last name. I just felt the need to bully her, and I punched her in the stomach. And very little time goes by without me feeling very sorry about that. And if I could find her, I would apologize to her.
My 50th anniversary will be coming up in about 2 years. And if I never hear from those people again, I will be happy. They couldn't be civil to me when we had no choice but to be together. I cannot imagine them being civil when we would volunteer to be together. I have no use for them. They left a burning hole in my soul. And I really don't ever want to even have to think about this again.
Wow. Marco from Oklahoma City talking about second grade, and Louise there in Anchorage, Alaska, who felt some misery in the class of 1966. So did Phil here, but he wants to bury the hatchet.
This is Phil Banzi from Macon, Georgia. I was definitely bullied as a kid, but what I'll say is, honestly, it made me strong. It made me be able to handle my situations in day-to-day life. By no means would I ever say that a student should be bullied. But I will say that, at least in my situation, it made me who I am, and I'm kind of grateful for it.
Coming up next, we'll be talking all about the pressures of high school and the difference between torture and teaching regarding bullying. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Share a story. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. What exactly is going on in high school, and how come Ferris Bueller had it so wired?
Oh, well, he's very popular, Ed. The sportos, the motorheads, geeks, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, they think he's a righteous dude.
Well, apparently Ferris was able to decode the complicated food chain that is high school. Not everyone is so good at it.
Okay, you should just know that we don't do this a lot, so this is like a really huge deal.
We want to invite you to have lunch with us every day for the rest of the week.
Oh, it's okay.
Coolness.
So we'll see you tomorrow.
On Wednesdays, we wear pink.
Kate in the movie Mean Girls thinks she's got it made being one of the pink plastics, but it doesn't quite work out so well. Were you popular back in high school or not so much? Were you mean to anybody that you would like to apologize to right now? Hurt by someone you would like to call out now? Well, without getting into any real names, tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want to talk about the complicated ways in which teens try to assert their independence, get ahead, and take down rivals. It's the focus of an in-depth survey of 4,200 8th, 9th, and 10th graders. University of California at Davis and Penn State researchers found significant stress levels associated with social competition at all levels of the hierarchy in high school, especially among those towards the top of the pyramid. The results, according to Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate and the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy, says the study goes way beyond our typical and simplistic view of high school bullying.
The classic example of bullying is this very one-way power dynamic where you have a campaign to make a kid miserable, and we think of that kid as being very socially isolated. And what this new study shows is that happens, but what's much more common is conflict among kids who are high status. They're kind of jockeying for a position as popular kids, and they're going after each other. And they are the ones who are reporting the highest levels of depression and anxiety from that experience.
How is that different from the Mean Girls story or the conflict among the jocks that's the narrative of almost every high school movie that you've ever seen?
I think it's very much related that you can see exactly this dynamic happening in Mean Girls, where as the main character starts to try to fit in her high school and get to be friends with high status kids, then those kids may turn on her. And so it's not that these kids are friendless. It's that there's a lot of cruelty that goes on in the social hierarchy in high school, which I think basically everyone who's been to high school will remember in some way, shape or form.
And, it's Lord of the Flies meets, American Graffiti on some level. We can't eradicate the cruelty and the pain that adolescence produces. But is there an amelioration? Is there some sort of guide here to at least giving better signposts to young people who really have to go it alone in this pretty ruthless competition?
Well, some of this is recognizing that kids need to learn to manage conflict, and we have to make some room for that. The tricky part is that we're not very good at predicting which kids will really be devastated by this kind of cruelty. You know, some kids are pretty armored up, and they can tough it out, and then the same experience will just really wreck another kid. But in this study, Robert Ferris, who is the author, makes a very good suggestion to try to address status in the ways in which they're trying to improve their school climates or prevent bullying. And the more routes you have to feeling good about yourself and thriving socially in school, the better. So instead of just having, the jocks and the mean girls, maybe it's just as cool to be a chess champion, or there are just lots of small pinnacles in a school community that kids can feel affirmed by.
You know, educator Leon Botstein of Bard has talked a lot about the question of whether high school is structurally just not put together to deal with all the different kinds of roles that high school students can have, that it's pretty much set up to be only about the mean girls and the jocks and maybe a few, straight A students, and everybody else is sort of lumped into this dumpster, and that makes it really, really hard to intervene.
Yeah, I often feel when I'm talking to teenagers, it's the only time in our lives where we're expected to be complete generalists, and where just being super good at one crazy nerdy thing isn't enough. Later in adulthood, no one ever asks you to be good at math and writing and singing, right? And yet we have that expectation. And then, you're right, athletics and other sort of typical American successful high school activities tend to be overvalued. And there is a very cramped feeling in some schools. But I have to say, in my reporting, I have gone to schools where there are just broader conceptions of who counts and of, what it even means to count, and a real emphasis on rewarding the kindness that students do to each other and making that the route to being valued and to being popular.
So we're asking people to kind of think back in their own lives, whether it was just a month ago that they left high school or several years, decades in my case. Is there a list in your life, Emily, of people who you maybe overstepped a line in being possibly cruel that you'd want to apologize to today, or folks that you'd want to say, hey, you made me feel pretty darn miserable? Could you make that list?
I have
a really powerful memory in eighth grade of having my friends desert me. That's how it felt to me. And I spent a lot of time at that moment really picking myself apart and feeling like it was my fault and just feeling tremendously isolated and scared at school. Because if you have no one to be friends with or to hang out with in a community and people are turning their backs on you, that is a really chilling experience. And that has really stuck with me. I think that if you have other support, and I was lucky to have a lot of support from my family, sometimes those experiences of adversity help you grow. And I think it was a humbling experience for me, and that was probably a good thing. But they do stick with us. And I've noticed in writing about this topic that almost everyone has some very deep-seated memory that comes to the surface when they start thinking back on being a teenager.
Anyone you'd want to apologize to? Anyone who you maybe wreaked some revenge for that eighth grade experience unwittingly later on in high school?
You know, I'm sure I should apologize to someone, but I don't think I ever had enough social clout or power to do any real damage in high school. So I think the apologies I would give are more inadvertent. I'm sure that there were moments when I turned my back and rejected someone because I didn't want to be associated with someone I thought just wasn't cool enough, rather than actually like trying to wreak revenge. I think that's what I'm guilty of.
Negotiating the hierarchies in high school, what we learn is that the would-be journalists were pretty low on the food chain, I guess, huh?
Well, at least this one. Maybe it's not true for you.
No, I'm with you. Emily Bazelon, the senior editor at Slate and author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Help is available at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and it wasn't close. The Huskies of UConn dog-tied the Irish of Notre Dame last night. Two undefeated teams began the women's NCAA final, but it couldn't end that way. 79-58 was the final score, the ninth national championship for the UConn women, the most in the women's game in NCAA history. But for the University of Connecticut basketball program, the Huskies also won the NCAA tournament on the men's side. This year's success is a tale of two very different basketball programs under one roof. Michelle Vopel covered last night's matchup for ESPN.com. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Michelle.
Hi, John. How are you?
How big of a surprise was it that the Huskies won? I mean, they are a complete legend here.
This one really wasn't a surprise. They had all their principal players back from last year's national championship team. I think all year long, everybody was expecting them to be in the final. Notre Dame was also an undefeated team. Unfortunately, Notre Dame lost a senior starter who had been their best player throughout the NCAA tournament. They lost her the game before the Final Four. Would that have made a difference? I think it would have made it a better game, but I don't think anybody was surprised to see UConn win its ninth national championship last night.
Even though the men, when they won the NCAA championship on Monday night, that was more of a surprise, and they were an underdog going in. Describe the contrast between these two programs. The women's program is unblemished. The men's program has a lot of problems, and there was even talk after the men won that, see, if you ban us, because the NCAA did ban UConn on the men's side, we come back stronger. What's the difference between these two programs?
I think it's sort of the difference in a lot of ways between men's and women's basketball. And I'm not saying that the women don't ever have any problems with recruiting violations or other issues, but there's just many more tentacles and so much more money on the men's side that there's more malfeasance on the men's side, frankly. And the other thing is in women's basketball, people stick around for 4 years. You have to go to school. You have to get decent grades. And so there's really, I have to say, a little bit less, you know, issues on the women's side in terms of problems like that. And in this case, this is also a program that really is unblemished, I would say. They do things the right way and both on and off the court.
Are they a model? I mean, you did describe the apples and oranges comparison between men's and women's NCAA basketball, but on some level, right on that campus, does the women's program say, this is how you should do things?
Yeah, I do think so. And I think that's one of the things about Gino Auriemma and Chris Daly, his assistant. I mean, they've been in those jobs at Connecticut since 1985. So they've, you know, literally raised a couple of generations of kids there, if you will. And they're young women who have done, you know, tremendous things in life. I mean, there's a lot of Olympians have gone through that program. UConn women's basketball players are so important to the foundation and the continuation of the WNBA. So what they've done there has meant a lot, not just to women's basketball, women's sports on that campus, but really women's sports internationally.
With the talk of possible unionization on the men's side in collegiate athletics, which was something that hung over the men's tournament this year, are men's and women's sports at the top level? And, you know, the UConn Huskies on the women's side are at the absolute top of their game, even worldwide. Are they getting farther apart or are they possibly coming together?
Revenue-producing sports, where they are revenue-producing, which those two sports aren't that everywhere, but men's basketball, men's football, I mean, we've known this for years. They are different entities and face different challenges than the non-revenue-producing sports. In terms, though, of competitive discipline and how good these programs are, how close these programs are to being professional, I'd say the top women's programs are very much like that, but they don't tend to have the other baggage.
Michelle Vopel writes for ESPN.com covering the NCAA Women's Tournament won by the UConn Huskies. Thanks so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Underground networks of border crossers in South Texas, money launderers, smugglers, these are familiar stories in the Rio Grande Valley. But here's a story of an underground network trading in something as old as it gets, vanity. Law enforcement officials say Latina women have been solicited and many have used the services of underground medical cosmetic treatments in the Rio Grande Valley, silicone injections, Botox. These illegal services have a name that doesn't inspire a lot of vanity, butt pumping. The procedure is unregulated and dangerous, resulting in amputations and death. San Juanita Herrera is one woman in South Texas who underwent the procedure in 2001.
Por vanidad o por uno de mujer,
because of vanity or I'm going to cry. A woman wants to look better. In that time, there was a woman who was giving butt injections. Some friends asked me if I wanted to get those injections because a lot of people were getting it done.
Estaba poniendo inyecciones.
San Juanita thought she was getting a Botox procedure. What she actually got is explained by legit cosmetic surgeon Filberto Rodriguez.
Anyone injecting silicone is doing so with a non-medical grade silicone that they tend to buy at Home Depot. The problem is when you get to this butt pumping, the amount of silicone that's being injected is massive.
Veronica Zaragovia, state reporter for KUT Austin, has uncovered this story. Veronica, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you, John.
So these two characters who you found in your reporting really tell the tale of a vast underground network, really, where people go to get cosmetic surgery in places that are completely and totally unregulated. What is this world that you found?
So there are some cases in which the women will go to spas or beauty salons and leave flyers in Spanish. It's definitely not done, you know, in an actual clinic or medical office.
And let's hear once more from San Juanita Herrera, who was speaking to you about, you know, how initially she really thought this was a good idea.
Back then, I felt really happy because I really liked the results. I looked really good. A whole bunch of us were really happy, but I didn't know then I was making a huge mistake.
How much was her life threatened by the injections that she received, do you think?
The complications can be pretty serious. She had, her skin was darkening and she had skin ulcerations, and she told me that it was becoming very painful to sit down. And as the cosmetic surgeon explained to me, one potential risk that could lead to death is when the silicone travels through the bloodstream and can clog the main artery of the lung. There can also be complications with gangrene. The body just really rejects this substance. And so the only way to do it where it doesn't cause any health risk is if the silicone, an FDA-approved version, is 100% inserted within the muscle so that there's no exposure to the skin or the blood.
And the cosmetic surgeon you spoke with, who told us a few minutes ago that this silicone comes sometimes from Home Depot, explains exactly what the risk is.
The risk of death from these silicone injections to the butt is that such a large volume of silicone that's being injected that it can actually embolize through the veins into the lungs, and that's what causes the immediate death. And that's a risk that these people are subjecting themselves to.
That's Filberto Rodriguez, a cosmetic surgeon who worked with San Juanita Herrera to really deal with the consequences of what she'd done in this underground network. Let's talk a little bit about how difficult it was to get anyone to really speak about this, Veronica.
That's right. It's very difficult because some of the women are undocumented and they don't want to share their identity. Others are in these occupations, such as exotic dancers or sex workers, who really don't want to speak up to law enforcement. The doctor did tell me that law enforcement was offering some money to help victims with their medical expenses if they would share who gave them these injections. And so that might be a method for them to be able to get more people to speak up. But they do think that there are many, many women who are victims, as well as women who are offering these services.
Reporting on the vulnerability of Latina women in Texas from an underground network of cosmetic surgeons, Veronica Zaragovia is a reporter for KUT in Austin. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
For some people, it's the place where they were born. For others, the place they went to college, fell in love. For Jane Byron, it's the city of Camden, New Jersey.
This is where I bought my first house, where I had my first child and heard my first gunshots. Camden. The city Walt Whitman dreamed was invincible, and the city I tried to help rebuild. Camden, the city where children live and dreams die.
Takeaway listener Jane Byron sent us those poignant lines in response to our invitation for you to be a part of a project for National Poetry Month around the simple words, "This is where," with the hashtag "This is where," and in collaboration with our friends down in Miami at WLRN, we're collecting poems beginning with the words, "This is where," from all over. For Jane Byron, Camden is a place she can no longer live in, but it's also a place she can never say goodbye to.
Well, I grew up right outside of Camden, but it could have been 3 hours away. I grew up in a town called Oakland, New Jersey, which was about maybe 6 miles from Camden, and I had little contact with Camden growing up, but my mother was born and raised there. And she had great fond memories of the shipyards and RCA and the workers and her father and all the neighbors and her cousins. So I grew up hearing about a Camden that bore no resemblance to the Camden that I grew up knowing.
And the Camden you saw was filled with, and I'm just going back to my own memories of Camden, having been there a few times, mm-hmm. liquor stores, buildings with no windows.
Right.
Vacant buildings.
And of course, prostitutes and drugs and needles and syringes and trash everywhere. And small children out on the streets just left to their own devices. That's kind of what I grew up with. But I also grew up with parents who were very active in the civil rights movement. And so Camden was also a place that we would go to and see this other side where there were political activists and priests. And I went to the Sacred Heart Church where Father Michael Doyle has been the Monsignor for a gazillion years. So I had these two sites of Camden, what came across on the Channel 6 news, and then what I saw through my parents' political activities, and then through the church that we often went to.
You heard your first gunshots in Camden. When? Where?
In the back alley of the house that I gutted and rehabbed. My daughter was probably a year old, maybe two at the most at the time. And there is, some shouting in the back alley, and then I heard gunshots, and then there was nothing.
The city you say you tried to help rebuild.
My mother was an early pioneer in Camden, where there was a historic district. And I was living in Los Angeles at the time when she bought a house in Camden, of all places. And so I came back to the East Coast in 1984, and I saw the beautiful home that she built. So I bought a house on the same street where my mother lived for $11,000 in 1985. And I got a HUD loan for $38,000. Because $38,000 even then couldn't do a total gut rehab. I did a lot of the work myself and would tear down the plaster and lath and pack it up in bags and drag it to the curb for trash day each week. So that was my part of rebuilding. First of all, moving in and trying to have a stable presence and taking one trashed house and rebuilding it into a home for my daughter and me.
Walt Whitman, you write, dreamed that Camden was invincible, and it sounds like you discovered a city that was everything but.
Yes, especially in that time. I do think that perhaps it is a different story since I am not right there next to it, but I do know it's still absolutely crime-ridden. But there are things that my mother tells me that are going on where hope springs eternal for many.
What was it that caused you to say, you know what, I've had enough?
Well, actually, it was a happy thing. I was part of a story for the university magazine. I worked at UMDNJ, and my husband, my now husband, was sent to photograph me and my daughter in our home. He came, we met, and we just connected very early and completely. And he lived in Morristown, and I love it up here. I really do. And when you have a child who is preschool age, it wasn't a tough decision. Camden, Morristown. Camden, Morristown. I think I'll go for Morristown.
I mean, for as close as those two places are, they are extreme opposites.
Yes, they are. It's 93 miles, and it's 93,000, you know, miles in terms of experience.
If I were to show up at your address where you formerly lived in Camden, what would I see?
A parking lot. There were three homes out of, I guess, the 10 or 12 on the block that were lovingly restored by my mother, myself, and one of our neighbors. And then the rest were kind of tragic messes and boarded up some. And so it's an entire block of a parking lot.
You know, it sounds like from your poem that, you know, regardless of how disillusioning it was to be in Camden on some level, you retain a lot of affection for the place.
I do. And I think you can't literally peel the walls off with your hands with a baby in a backpack and not have fondness. There was a lot. I get emotional. It was a lot of hard work. And I am a dreamer.
Jane Byron now lives in Morristown, New Jersey, even though part of her heart remains in Camden, New Jersey. Next Wednesday, another poem from you. So here's how you can participate. In verse or in a few lines, describe a place that is important to you. It must include the phrase, "This is where." Tweet it to us using the hashtag #ThisIsWhere, all one word, or submit it to us online at thetakeaway.org. If you're in South Florida, be sure to tweet it to @WLRN to be entered into their poetry contest this month. WLRN has been picking 10 of their favorite poems each week. Eduardo Lease of Miami writes this poem about North Beach, or Nobe, in Miami. "This is where I walked with nothing, unemployed. Walgreens bathing suit, where I later splashed full of love and peaches. I go, it's there, no questions, no answers. Vast ocean, open winds, the roundness of the earth. I am just feet in the sand. I could be foam. The beach to be alone, breathe to be together, laugh to be in love, kiss to dream with clenched fingers. The beach to bury your head in the sand or have the courage to do cartwheels." Send us your poems about the places that matter to you. The hashtag is, once again, "This is where."
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Animation is an art form that goes way beyond movie making. It's part sculpture, part puppetry and dance, part painting and music. The making of animated movies is a unique creative enterprise that makes this radical deal with the soul of every viewer. If you will believe that this completely fake world is real, in return, we will deliver a story that works and characters you will never forget.
Just eat the blossom. That's the good stuff.
Thumper?
Yes, Mama.
What did your father tell you?
About what?
About eating the blossoms and leaving the greens.
Oh, that one. Eating greens is a special treat. It makes long ears and great big feet. But it sure is awful stuff to eat. I made that last part up myself.
Little Thumper the Bunny, can you see him in your mind from the 1942 Disney animated classic Bambi? Walt Disney changed the movies and a lot more with his cartoon features. The bar here, creatively speaking, was very high by the time what became the animation company Pixar was formed in 1979 and acquired by Steve Jobs in 1986. And Jobs started asking the very same questions Walt Disney asked about how you mobilize creativity to make a story work without breaking the bank.
So how do you do it? Well, Walt Disney himself solved this problem decades ago. He said, we have to edit our film before we make it, not after. You get your story team together, and you do storyboards. You do these little pictures for every key scene. But that wasn't enough. Then what he did was he actually photographed them on film. He filmed each picture. And then he got his scratch voices, people around the studio to do the voices, and he'd even put in some scratch music. And then he could watch his movie. And we still do that today. We use video, we were more sophisticated at it. But basically, we build our movie before we make it. And invariably, what you think is going to work crashes and burns when you see it in the reels. And you iterate on these reels thousands of times. And only when it works in the reels do you then go animate it and actually produce it.
You, my friend, are responsible for delaying my rendezvous with Star Command. You are a toy!
Toy Story in 1995 put Pixar on the map in animation, in Hollywood, and as an entertainment franchise. Today, Pixar, you might say, is the map. Acquired by Disney in 2006, Pixar's success is often claimed to be about the triumph of technology. That's wrong. And the late Steve Jobs would be the first one to say it. Pixar's success is the triumph of a lot of talented people, and especially the triumph of a set of ideas about creativity. Ideas laid out in the book Creativity, Inc. by the president and co-founder of Pixar, also author Ed Catmull, who joins us. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you.
How did you see that the creative sort of iteration, design approach, team approach at Disney and Pixar could really be replicated as a strategy for developing creativity in virtually any enterprise?
Well, when I was a kid growing up, Disney was my idol, as well as was Einstein. And I really loved the impact that the stories had on me as a kid. But I realized when I got into college that I couldn't draw that well, so I switched over into physics. When I got to graduate school, it was the early days of computer animation. We were essentially inventing it. And I realized at that time that we could combine the graphics of the computers with the art. So I had a goal to make the first feature animated film, and that goal took 20 years. And initially, it was this great creative endeavor of art and technology coming together just to figure out how to do it. But while going through that wonderful experience, near the end, I realized that every time I looked at other creative endeavors, they fell apart after a while. It's like, Disney fell apart for a while after Walt died.
Sure.
But I saw this happen all over the place. So at the end of achieving this marriage of art and technology, I could see this really interesting problem, and that is, how do you keep a group together? How do you keep the creative juices going? And what are the things that get in the way that cause those other places to fall apart?
And this book is about the story of how in the group shot of the success of Toy Story, you were the one person not smiling, terrified that it was all going to fall apart. And so you really started to focus on a deeper problem. This book is filled with a lot of the really fantastic creative people at Pixar telling you their dreams, their metaphors about how scary it is to make a creative picture. Brad Bird has a dream. Andrew Stanton of Finding Nemo has a dream in here. How important are those metaphors about the creative process for you?
I think the thing that most people don't realize is when we start to make a film and we first get that idea up there and look at it, that it really sucks. And I don't mean this in a self-effacing sense. What I mean is, like, it really does suck. It's very difficult, and it's hard for these people. They get it in their heads. They're invested in it. They lose objectivity, and they're groping with trying to make something that doesn't work and turn it into something that does work. And that's a really hard process, and it's a scary process. So what we try to figure out is, how do we enable them and allow them to go through this process of making mistakes and errors and failures and work their way through this unknown territory?
Nobody gets bullied for erasing 2 years of digital archives at Pixar.
No. Here's the thing is if you're doing something new, you will make mistakes. In fact, if you're not making mistakes, you're probably just copying other things. The way you avoid mistakes is to be super safe. Well, we can't be safe. So that means somebody will make mistakes, and we have to say, oh, well, let's learn from it. But you don't bully anybody, or you punish them, or quote, hold them accountable. In fact, what you're trying to do is to make it safe for them to try something new.
Andrew Stanton has a story in here about how he views a movie as, climbing a mountain blindfolded. The first thing you have to do is find the mountain. You reject that and say, no. Get rid of the mountain. Invent the future. That's how to get there.
Well, it was actually Michael Arndt, the writer of Toy Story 3, who gave the metaphor. And he was giving the metaphor as his way of trying to deal with the difficulties of creating the unknown. Andrew says, fail as fast as you can, because he knows that he's going to fail. But he uses this metaphor of, like, he's a sailor out in the sea, and he doesn't know which way to go. But he's got to pick a direction. And I rejected the metaphors because they sort of implied that something already exists. And in my view, the thing they're working on doesn't exist. But in some ways, I was wrong, because each of these directors needs something to hang on to when they're navigating these uncharted territories. And so the metaphors are their ways of just grabbing on and saying, I'm going to do something while I forge ahead, and I don't know exactly where I'm going.
Before we go, just between you and me, got any jobs at Pixar? Like radio guys?
Can you?
Creative,
Well,
I can draw a little.
Can you write?
Yeah.
Writing's good.
We'll talk. Ed Catmull, author of Creativity, Inc. and president of Pixar and Disney Animation. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Pixar is a bully-free zone, but not so much on screen. Sid in Toy Story, Happy in A Bug's Life. Were you the bully or were you bullied in school? Share your story. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. From Bernardsville, New Jersey, I'm sorry to be the boy I made cry by disagreeing. I've since grown to appreciate the value of bat out of hell. You monster. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.